Hello, everyone. I'm Nate Truax, and you're listening to the CrocCast Podcast.
Hey, everyone. Just a little quick note before the podcast begins. I'll be going to Kluberfest at the Indianapolis Convention Center from September 27th to the 29th. So if you see me there, feel free to stop by and say hi, and we can have a little talk. So if you want to look up tickets for that, that'll be on the Show Me Reptiles page, and just look up there, and hopefully I'll see you there. Thanks.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the CrocCast Podcast. And today I'm joined by Chad Keats, research fellow at the South African Institute of Aquatic Biodiversity and head scientist at Hanguzi Explorations. Chad, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So you want to get started on how you first got into reptiles and amphibians? And what kind of led you to where you are now?
Okay, cool. So when I was really young, I wasn't the biggest fan of snakes. I was a bit scared, to be honest. And then one of my preschool, I was like 5 or 6 years old, someone came to my school and they put the African python on our lap. And then I was sold. So I was like, I like these things. They're pretty cool. Obviously, I started the normal way. I kept a few snakes as I was growing up, got to varsity, started doing zoology and journalism together. And over time, my interest for snakes kind of had a big resurgence. So I was like, okay, I like reptiles. I like amphibians. And now that I'm doing zoology at an honors level, there's definitely a way I can work on these as a career. So then I did masters, got into genetics, working on African snakes. And that led from one thing to another, upgraded to a PhD, got my PhD. And ever since then, I've been working on African snake, lizard, frog systematics all over Africa. So I've been everywhere. So I've just come out of Congo now. That was the most gnarly trip I've done. But very cool place.
Great. So what led you into wanting to look into basically most of Africa's reptile amphibians systemics?
So I guess it was just opportunity. It was lucky. I guess when I was at varsity, the herpetologist that was present was a taxonomist and a phylogeneticist. So when I started doing my master's program, it was one with a thesis based in African snake systematics with a genetic component. So that's how I got into it. And then once I got in, I really enjoyed it. So I continued doing it. And then one thing led to another. I was getting invited on trips. I was becoming more proficient in the field, better in the lab, get invited on more trips. And then you get to go see cooler and cooler places. So kind of just led from one thing to another. I never went into varsity wanting to be a geneticist on reptiles, but I'm there now. So yeah, there's one thing.
So are there any particular groups you've been focusing your efforts on?
So my PhD focused on the Simophidae family. So your African whip snakes, your scarp stickers, your field snakes, kind of your generalist widespread groups, very similar to your coach whips in America, fast. They very quick. Everyone thinks it's the same species, but there's lots of different species and they're very fast. So no one actually gets a good close look at them. They like to bite, but they're they're very charismatic, very beautiful snakes that tend to be quite locally abundant wherever you find them. So I've worked on that for my PhD. And over time, I've picked up different groups. I've worked on pygmy toads. I've worked on reed frogs. I've worked on water snakes. Some of my recent research I'm working on worm slungs now. I've done a bit of stuff on vipers. So I've definitely dabbled and tried different groups. I'm not a specialist by any means. I don't specialize in any specific taxon, as you would with entomology, where someone might be a coleopterist or work on Odysseus or something. We are lucky that you can, there's not that many things that you can't just work on everything.
So with these what do you call them, dwarf toads, what do you call them?
Pygmy toads.
I haven't heard much about those before. You want to go over kind of the general information about those guys?
Yeah, well, they're just they're quite an interesting group. They're part of Bufonidae, so they're kind of really mini toads. They're quite interesting in their habits. So we described two new species of them in Angola last year. So that was pretty big news because they're quite common throughout their range. But where we found them, it was quite interesting because it was definitely an artifact of speciation. So like they got to an area. And over time, because of the abiotic factors, they speciated and became several new species, which we recently described with some Portuguese researchers and Angolan researchers, and it was led by a scientist called Dr. Nunda Baptista. So a really interesting study. They're an interesting group of animals. Some of them are earless, some of them aren't. They live in like rocky outcrops in like puddles that exist in those puddles. So you find them in summer, but in winter, you're going to struggle to find them. So they interesting group. And once we had a go at the osteology, the genetics and the morphology, it was pretty clear cut that they were different species that had become distinct quite a long time ago.
Okay. And how far back would we say they have speciated from their closest relatives?
To be completely honest with you, we didn't do time calibrated phylogenetics in that one, so I wouldn't be able to give you an answer. We used a very basic phylogenetic reconstruction. So in order to give an estimate of that, I'd have to do time calibrated phylogenetics, and we didn't actually get around to doing it. It was so clear cut that we didn't have to go that deep. So to be honest, I can't give you that answer. Sorry.
Okay. Reason I was asking that because I'm kind of interested in how far away they're related to toads that are more familiar to an American like myself or Europeans. So.
Oh, okay, yeah. So, well, their closest relative is Matenzafrini, also another African toads group. They, I guess, distantly, you start getting to the Sclerophus, which are your larger ones. You guys get Bufo, right? Like, that's one of your groups. So, Bufo would be quite distant, but it's all in the same family. So, you've got, they'll be in the same. So, they're more closely related to your Bufonids than they would be to, let's say, for example, reed frogs or any other kind of frog. So they're not too far away, but they definitely have been in Africa a very long time. To the best of my knowledge, yeah, actually they are. You only find the pygmy toads, which is Pornophrynus, in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa.
Okay. So you also did some work with reed frogs. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, so reed frogs, they're quite interesting. They're very beautiful, very charismatic frogs. Very similar to what you guys would consider your tree frogs in America. They kind of arboreal. You can find them anywhere. And I don't know if it's true for yours, but like they do very well around like human like habitation. They'll just like stick to a pane of glass and they'll change colors. Yeah. And then they'll like that. They kind of that. It's very similar. There's a lot of analogs in Africa to America. So like one thing I found really interesting when I was last there is that when we go look for things, you'll find an animal that fills a very, very similar niche in America to in South Africa. So our centipede eaters look identical to your ones. You have a centipede eater, right? It's got like a black-headed centipede eater kind of thing.
Yeah, like I think it was like more like a Southwest United States, I believe. But
okay, yeah. Well, there's something that looks identical. And then you get the coach whips and the whip snakes. Their habits are the same. Their morphology looks very similar. A lot of your tree frogs look very similar to our reed frogs. Your toads, like, very not much in it. And you find these very interesting color patterns. So we get some things like harlequin snakes, which have like these like very colorful rings. And there's several species of snake in America that have a very similar morphology, and they exist in a very similar niche. So their ecologies are also very similar. So I find it fascinating that two continents that are completely different can have animals that are occupying very similar niches. So it's a very interesting thing to look at as an evolutionary biologist, because you can see that even though these things aren't linked, the way that nature or environment exerts a pressure on an animal is very interesting across, or very similar across space and time.
Yeah. Same requirements require similar forms and functions, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. So like if you're in an environment where there's water that's a temporary, so you're losing your water source very quickly, you're going to have animals that evolve to occupy those niches similarly. It doesn't really have to be close, just as long as they, and then through time, they could attain a very similar morphology.
Yeah. So with your work with reed frogs, what in particular were you looking at?
So we haven't published anything on it, but we're looking into some of the green ones. So in Africa, or sub-Saharan Africa, you get a group of frogs. It's kind of called the Hyperoleus nasutus complex or Benguelensis complex. It's like all the little green frogs. and they're really hard to distinguish. Like, it's hard to say which one's which. They all look the same, they all act the same, they all do the same thing, but based on the taxonomy, there's very clear distinctions based on geography. But unfortunately, when you go into areas where there's contact zones, so you find a place that's kind of, they overlap, it can be very challenging. So we're very keen to get samples from the broader group, most of the different species of green frog, and see using a, if we can, like, using a combination of genetics, morphology, distribution, and like osteology, whether there actually is all these species, or it's just kind of just like one species that just is has evolved to basically exist all over sub-Saharan Africa.
All right, gotcha. So you said you did your PhD on whip snakes.
Yeah.
I'm going to be honest, I don't know much about whip snakes other than what you just said about them being very, very similar to Kluber and Coach Whips over here.
Yeah, very similar, yeah.
So well, the similarities transfer over to their diet as well, where they're kind of like diurnal chase down lizard eaters.
It's exactly the same, yeah. Like, it's weird. Like, a lot of our guys, they go for... So you have teads, right? They're all in teared day. You're kind of your ground living lizards. They kind of have, they're scaly, long fingers. They live in desert, like sandy areas. And our ones would be called Lacertidae. So that's what our snakes are off. Like, our whip snakes are eating a very similar thing to what your coach whips are eating that side. So it's very interesting in terms of the ecology. Also, they're very fast. They're diurnal. They're widespread. Similar to ours, and they have a very similar diet, which consists largely of lizards. Sometimes they're supplemented with rodents, and even in some cases frogs. They're also mildly venomous. Are your ones also slightly mildly venomous? Slight.
Like, they might be very slightly, but as far as I know, they're non-venomous.
Oh, they compete. Okay, because our ones are mildly. It doesn't really have an effect on humans, but they're considered mildly venomous. Yeah. And it's, yeah, so yeah, they are, it can be very similar. So when I came over, I was in Arizona, New Mexico, just for a little bit, having some fun. And I saw them, and it just blows my mind how similar they are to our ones.
Yeah. Out of curiosity, does South Africa have any sort of analogs to, say, gopher snakes or king snakes?
Gopher king snakes, like snakes that eat other snakes, king snakes in terms of what they look like or what they do, or their ecology?
Their ecology.
The ecology, yeah. So for a king, to be honest with you, off the top of my head, I can't think of anything that there is a few that are kind of similar in terms of king snakes. My best understanding of a king snakes are quite robust. They're large. They are they're non-venomous constrictors, right? And they tend to specialize in eating other snakes, right?
Snakes and other reptiles, yeah.
Snakes and other reptiles, yeah. So we do have several groups of snakes that occupy a very similar niche, like not large, but kind of like medium size, like kind of like looking at like 80 centimeters to a meter kind of size, and they have very similar habits to them. Yeah, but not to the best of my knowledge, we don't have anything that's kind of a gopher snake. Gopher snake's quite an interesting looking animal. We have snakes that have a beaked snout, which allows them to kind of bury themselves and dig in the soil, but nothing off the top of my head that I can think of that's very like a gopher snake, but I might be wrong. I might be just missing something.
Okay. Yeah. I was just curious if South Africa or Africa in general had sort of like a mid-sized rodentiferous constrictor or not.
Oh, we have a lot of them. Yeah. Yeah. So the whip snakes will fall into that category. Then you start getting the mole snakes, the Pseudaspis, which can get huge. So you get like a meter to 2 meter. They're absolutely monsters, as thick as your forearm. They're like our largest non-venomous snake in South Africa after the python itself, and they are considered by a lot of people to be dangerous, not because they have venom, it's because their teeth, they're very sharp and they got big teeth. And the reason for that is that when they hunt, they often hunt in rodent burrows where it's very tight, so instead they can't really like strike, grab and constrict. So what they do is they bite onto the animal and they kind of rip it apart with their teeth, and that's how they kill it. So when it bites a person, it's gonna end up in stitches. So you don't want to get bitten by a mole snake. So yeah, they also quite an gnarly species of animal that we get out here, especially on the West Coast in Cape Town. And they can change colors dramatically. You get some parts of the country, they're pure black. Other places, they're red. Other places, they're brown. And I've even seen white ones. So it's a very interesting group of snakes. Well, one snake.
What was the scientific name for that group again?
Pseudaspis canna. It's a monotypic genus. So there's only the mole snake that exists in the genus Pseudaspis.
Pseudaspis, okay. Yeah. So You mentioned you did a little bit of work with venomous species.
Yes, we do. I have done some. The thing is that, well, it depends on what guys are working on. So, like, everyone loves to work on venomous snakes. So that's where the systematics is actually very well known. So Africa is incredibly well known for vipers. Everyone loves our vipers. You've got Nassiphornis, you've got the rhinoceros, you've got the gaboon, then you've got the dwarf adders down south. We've got all of our dwarfs. They've got the berg adders, like your British, you get the armata, you get the fabled albanica, all these amazing things, but they're being very much worked on right now. So a lot of guys are working on viper genetics and viper phylogeography, trying to see the trends and where they exist and what niches they occupy. So the snakes that kind of fall through the cracks, or the animals that fall through the cracks, generally, like, this is just the way things are with charisma. It's like less charismatic, more space to work on them. No one wants to work on worm lizards. It's not as exciting. Thread snakes aren't as exciting as cobras. So the cobra stuff is pretty much done. Like, unless you look at like very, very specific genetic markers and you look at like the whole genome of one species, we have a pretty good idea of where our Southern African cobras fit in. But if you want to have a good idea of, well, like, let's say the African thread snakes or blind snakes, like, we haven't got a clue what's going on yet. So it's amazing. And that's one thing that's really, really appealing about working in Africa, is that we still have the ability to find new species pretty readily if you know where to look. So that's what's interesting. And in terms of the venomous snakes, I'm currently working with a professor from America named Professor Eli Greenbaum, work on some of the boomslangs and vine snakes, and we're looking at the whole group. So he had a student doing his PhD a few years back, and right now they're kind of finishing that project off. So I'm adding in a few more samples for them. We're looking at the morphology and genetics, and we're going to be having a look at the boomslangs and the vine snakes and everything in between to see where they sit.
Gotcha. Well, speaking of cobras, how they fit in, I've been trying to find a solid definition of what defines the genus Naja, and I can't seem to find it no matter how much I dig through ResearchGate.
Oh yeah, yeah. So get Naja, and it, yeah, I know what you mean.
Try to find why Aspidolaps is not Naja, so to speak.
To be honest with you, I've grown up with these things, so I can just say it's this or that. But like, to say it from a taxonomical point of view, I'd have to pull out a key for you. But then obviously in Africa, or South Africa specifically, we get Naja and then we get Hemacartus for the wrinkles. Yeah. And everyone's like, what's the difference between the two? So, well, one of the easiest ways to see is that, well, Naja, so you got your forest cobra, you got your snouted cobra, your cape cobras, your black spitters, all those ones. And then you've got your wrinkles, which also can have a black, you get a black wrinkles with the white bars in the neck, and guys get confused. Well, wrinkles have keeled scales, like they're quite rough on the back, and all the cobras are smooth. They're completely smooth. They've got no keeled scales. And then wrinkles are live bearing, and the Naja lay eggs. So that's how you distinguish those groups. And then obviously, with between the other lapids, like your sea snakes, your Aspidolaps, and all of them, there's going to be distinguishing characteristics. But yeah, the most well-known one is wrinkles to cobra. How do you know the difference? Why is a wrinkles not a cobra? It's like a pseudo cobra. It has very similar morphology. It's got a hood. It can spit. But even the mechanism by which it spits is different. It doesn't really inject it, or I mean, doesn't exactly spray it like a Mozambican spitting cobra or a black spitter, but rather
it's more like he slings it.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's that awesome video done with by Wolfgang Wuster in the lab. They did some great research on elapids, and they show that so once you see these animals in the field, you don't make the mistake anymore. But looking in the books, you're like, well, what makes them different? They are distinguishable keys and characters for them.
Yeah, actually, a friend of mine who's another reptile podcaster here in the States, he lives in Florida. He keeps a lot of African venomous, including wrinkles. He's actually said that those are his favorite snakes. So.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, his name's
Phil. Yeah, they're interesting animals.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Yeah, they're very charismatic snakes. Unfortunately, they've definitely caught a few people out because they play dead. So they're like the ultimate examples of thanatosis. And unfortunately, because of that, you often find one lying like that. Sometimes people make the mistake of thinking it's a dead snake, or a dog or a cat tries to play with it, and it doesn't end well. So they don't actually bite a lot of people in South Africa. It doesn't, because they're actually more prone to spitting and throwing their venom. So most people that get affected by these snakes, it's more venom in the eye. So getting bitten by a wrinkles takes quite a bit of talent. You've got to kind of like walk past the snake trying to spit at you to put your leg close enough to get bitten, because they're not the fastest snakes on the planet. So a lot of guys who get bitten by them, generally unlucky hikers, very unlucky hikers, snake handlers, and obviously snake catchers. They sometimes get bitten, but they're not a snake that often bites people, but a lot of people get affected by the venom in the eyes. It does happen.
Okay, gotcha. Have you done any, well, this is the Crocast podcast, obviously, so I'm going to have to ask, have you done any research with crocodilians at all?
Me? No, not yet, unfortunately. Crocodiles are an awesome group of animals. We only, obviously, in my part of the world, we only have the one. We have the Nile croc, so Crocodilus niloticus. There's a lot of work going into them. Obviously, they're a very important species from a management point of view and conservation point of view because of the danger they are. They're quite a dangerous animal, especially around people. And in South Africa, they exist in many of the rivers and waterways on the eastern side of the country. So you go into KwaZulu-Natal, Mpumalanga, Limpopo, if there's a large body of water or a large river, sometimes not even big water, there's crocodiles around. So they definitely are being focused on heavily in terms of behavioral stuff, conservation stuff, and management stuff. No one's really looking at the systematics anymore. We're pretty happy with what a crocodile, a Nile crocodile is, but there's a lot of guys looking at Nile crocodiles in South Africa, to the best of my knowledge. So I've just never got around to doing it, and it also kind of falls outside of my specialty. I'm more taxonomy, genetics, and there is no real need to work on them here in our country on that at that point, in this point in time on that.
Gotcha. Well, you at the very beginning of the show, you mentioned you just got back from the Congo. Do you want to talk about that trip at all?
Yeah, it was an awesome trip. Just got back. So I work for Hankuzi Exploration. So it's a NPC, a nonprofit company, that basically the mandate of the organization is to work in remote parts of Africa and basically render services in regards to biodiversity monitoring, produce surveys, and then also pair that with media so we can try and get the message out there. So we recently did a big expedition to DRC. So we went to Pemba National Park in the south of DRC. We worked in collaboration with the Forgotten Parks Foundation, the ICCN, the University of Lubumbashi, and a whole slew of other people to kind of document the wildlife on the Kibara Plateau within the park, Pemba National Park. Unfortunately, the area is quite hot. Everyone knows that Congo is quite a dangerous place. It's not a fun place to work in. People can be, especially in the higher ups, especially in terms of the bureaucracy, it's not an easy place to work. And then it's also a bit dangerous. So in Goma right now, in the eastern part, they're having a massive war, a civil war there. So we're working south of that. But there's always the threat from the local Mai Mai rebels that unfortunately are not so happy with the park's existence. So there's lots of tension between the rangers and military within the park and the Mai Mai rebels. And when we worked there, we had to have armed escorts the whole time. There was a lot of AK-47s around the whole time. But yeah, we got some cool deliverables. I was responsible for putting together the science team. And my boss was obviously responsible for putting together the expedition. And while we were there, we collected some awesome water data. I set up white snake traps and frog traps and lizard traps. We had a butterfly expert, a plant specialist, and we had a mammalogist. And what was really cool about this trip is that, generally speaking, when I do these things, I try to just go look for new species. But that wasn't the case on this one. The area has been pretty well surveyed by the Belgians back in the 1940s. So what we were trying to do was try to get a better understanding of what animals are occupying what parts of the park at what times of year. Because obviously, in order to manage an area, you need to know what animals are occupying which different spaces. So the area is characterized, the Kibara Plateau, by large rolling grasslands, gallery forests, and wetlands. So we tried to we set up white traps, so snake white traps with mesh funnels and bucket traps in the middle in the three different biotypes, and we paired them up with camera traps for large mammals, song meters for birds, bats, and frogs, Sherman traps for small rodents, and we basically sampled them in two different sites for 20 days. And we got some great data, so we're hoping to analyze that pretty soon. Got some eDNA from the water, got some soil sample, and then found some awesome snakes as well. I've got some cool photos I'll be putting up in the next few weeks. And it was an awesome trip, but yeah, Congo is not for the faint of heart. It's an intense country. Yeah, a lot of fun. A lot of fun working in these kinds of places, and it's definitely needed. And I was incredibly impressed with the park. The management of the park is amazing. The Tina Lane, very, very good at her job. University of Lubumbashi, which is the university in the south parts of Congo in the Katanga province, very good. Very good scientists. So it was a great opportunity for me and my team to collaborate with locals on local research. It was great to see some awesome reptiles and amphibians from that part of the world. The frogs are particularly amazing out there. They're beautiful. So even though it went in winter, not the best time of year, we still saw some cool stuff. Yeah.
I was going to say, scrolling through Instagram, you do post a lot of frog photography. So
yeah, I love frogs. That's a bit of an obsession.
It's always nice to see.
Yeah, so obviously in Africa, it's not a thing, I don't think, but like over time, I started with snakes, everyone starts with snakes, but you slowly start to have this massive appreciation for frogs. They're such interesting animals. They live in both the aquatic and the terrestrial environments. They tadpoles and then they turn into frogs. It's just such an interesting group of animals, and they're so critical to ecosystems. And they're also a lot more rewarding. I'm sure when you go out herping, you can flip rocks the whole day and never find a snake. But at least with frogs, they're cool, so you know they're there. Snakes don't call, so things are a bit more fun, yeah. Especially when it's hard out herping.
Yeah. Was there any particular favorite finds from your Congo expedition?
So I'm still looking at some of the systematics, but one of my favorite things on the whole planet is it's called Branches Beak Snake. So it's called Cladirostratus branchii. It's part of the Simophidae family. So it's kind of a whip snake kind of thing, very fast. What meant so much for me about that animal was that when I was first doing my master's, we found this, obviously we were working on the genus, and we found that this one species that we worked on was so distinct from the rest of the ones in the genus that it needs to be described as a new genus. And unfortunately, one of the most prolific researchers in Southern Africa, his name was Professor Bill Branch, amazing man. He passed away later in that year. So we decided to describe the genus in honor of him. So we called it Branches Beak Snake or Cladirostratus. And it just meant a lot to me because he was my hero growing up. He was like one of the best herpetologists in Africa, and he left way too soon. But the best thing I could do at the time as a young researcher was to describe this beautiful animal after him, just to kind of show an appreciation for what he's done for African herpetology. And seeing it in the field is awesome because you don't get them in South Africa. They're common in Zambia, Angola, and DRC, but you don't get them in South Africa, Botswana, Zimbabwe. So it was one of probably the highlights of the trip was seeing it in the wild.
All right, gotcha. What are some other places in Africa that you've got a chance to go to thanks to Hangtuzi Explorations?
So I've only recently started with Hangtuzi Explorations. But I've been with them to Zambia in 2021. We went to northern Zambia and we did some sampling up there. Beautiful part of the world. For anyone that's keen to visit Africa, as someone that's lived here my whole life, I'd probably recommend, in terms of logistics and ease, if you want to come and work in Africa, if you want to see African wildlife, go on a safari. Zambia is pretty high up there. It's logistically easier. The people are very open and they're kind of very open to tourism, so it's not as hard as some other countries. So Zambia is up there, South Africa is up there, Botswana, very good, Namibia. Obviously, there's some places in Africa I wouldn't recommend people go to unless you've got some experience, but Zambia is definitely up there, mainly because it's such a beautiful country. It's got so much diversity, and the reptiles and amphibians are particularly amazing up there, especially in the north. You start getting these really interesting animals in the north as you get out of like the more arid regions of the southern African region. It gets more tropical up there, so it becomes very interesting. Besides Hangtuzi, I've worked before that during my postdoc. I joined the National Geographic Okavango Wilderness Project when they were doing their research in Angola, and I've done two trips now to Angola, and Angola is absolutely amazing. It's the reason it's been doing so well and there's so many new species coming out of the region is because it was so undersampled for such a long time. Unfortunately, because of that, there was a big civil war happening for a very long time, it excluded people from doing research in the region. So now that's come to an end and the country's opening up to tourism, there's opportunities now to do research there. And if you go and look at some of the research that's coming out of there, they describe tons of species, reptiles, amphibians. They even describe the new species of buck. So that's amazing. Like a small buck. Like I don't know how no one spotted it. It's amazing. And then you get tons of new insects, some new country records of birds, lots of new fish. So Angola is very close to my heart because it was the first time I went out of my comfort zone into like a really interesting place and found some interesting stuff back when I was in masters. But yeah, I've worked in South Africa, Botswana, a little bit in Namibia, been to Mozambique. So I've done basically every country in the SADC region. So that's Southern Africa, except for Malawi. I haven't done Malawi yet. I haven't got there yet, but very keen to start pushing up into Central Africa. I would love to get into East Africa as well. It's beautiful up there, beautiful wildlife up there. But yeah, Africa is a big continent.
Yeah.
And over with time, I'm hoping to get into different countries.
Yeah. So is there any particular group of reptiles that you like working with the most?
Well, a group of reptiles I would really like to work with, which I find very interesting, would probably be some of the colubrids. So we've got less colubrids than you guys do, but almost all of our colubrids are very charismatic. So you got the green snakes, which are philothamnous. You get the tiger snakes, Telescopus. Obviously, you've got the boomslang, Diasphalitis. You get the vine snakes, Thalatornis. All these animals are very vibrantly colored. Most of them are arboreal, got massive eyes, very charismatic, lots like awesome behavior. So that's probably a group of, well, a family of snakes that I'd probably be very interested to work on. In terms of frogs, I've got a massive soft spot for tree frogs. So in Africa, our tree frogs fall into a genus called Leptopelis, and they are such beautiful animals. They've got these massive toes, big eyes, beautiful calls. And I find them to be absolutely fascinating, especially in the tropical region. So I would love to do more research on them. And if I had the opportunity, I would like to do some more research on chameleons. So South Africa is one of the best places in the world for chameleons. We've got a huge diversity of chameleons. It's been really well done by Professor Crystal Tolley out in Sambia in Cape Town. She's described several new species in collaboration with Marius Berger and Colin Tilbury and a whole group of other scientists. But there's definitely scope for research on chameleons. They're a very interesting group of animals. And from a behavioral point of view, they're very interesting. So I would, if I was given the opportunity to work a bit on chameleons, I would definitely say yes.
Gotcha. Nice. So for a first time person, a first time for someone going to Africa to go herping, what would you say is the best place to do that at?
So it honestly depends on what you want to see. So like if you are someone that wants to see a certain group of animals, I'd say go certain places. To be honest with you, like there's definitely places you should go first time and you shouldn't go first time. South Africa is a pretty good one. I would say I've lived in South Africa my whole life. Obviously, there's all these horrible stories everyone says about the country and Africa and how dangerous it is. But South Africa's got its stuff together. And there's a lot of interesting biodiversity in South Africa. You can see a lot in South Africa. So coming to South Africa for the first opportunity in Africa would probably be a good place to come. You can see lots of cobras. You can see the mambas. You can see all the vipers. If you're interested in frogs, there's a huge diversity of frogs. The chameleons are out of this world. Our tortoise diversity is amazing. Our gecko diversity is even better. So it kind of has a bit of everything. And because of where it is in Africa, combined with its climate and its topography, it's got huge diversity in terms of biomes. We have so much structural diversity. You've got forests in the east, and you've got like sandy coasts in the west. Then you've got almost deserts in the north, and in the south it becomes thickets. So you really have a nice spread of biomes, and they're not so far away. So America is an enormous continent. I learned that last time I came in. You go, cool, I'm going to go look for rattlesnakes in not New Mexico. I'm like, no, you're in Florida. It's a bit far.
Yeah.
South Africa is a lot easier to traverse, especially if you're confident in yourself and your ability to get a rental car. You can drive across the country in like 2 days pretty easily, 2.5 days, and you can see a huge diversity of things in just 2 days. So it's a cool place to come sample for your first time, especially if you get someone local to help you do it. And you can come see some awesome animals, do some photography. So South Africa is pretty much high up there. Otherwise, there's some great tours happening in Kenya. There's some good stuff happening in Tanzania. Interesting things in Namibia. I know some guys are doing some cool stuff in Namibia. Zambia's got some interesting things, but there's tours all over the place. The trick is just to find someone that actually knows what they're doing and is going to do it ethically and responsibly and legally. So there's a big legal component to doing this in Africa. Different countries have different rules. You can't just pick up anything you see or photograph certain things unless you know. So going with someone that knows the rules and is following the rules is going to make life a lot easier for you, because you don't want to get picked up by African police forces no matter where you go, because the language barrier, also being a foreigner, is not going to help. So as long as you're doing things by the book and you're working with someone that knows what they're doing, I think Africa is a very accessible place to do to buy tourism. And I think the country, I think Africa needs it, to be honest. It's great opportunity for the continent to get some injection of money from tourism for more than just mammals, because everyone comes on safari, but Africa is an amazing place for reptiles and amphibians too.
Just growing up, this guy really liked reptiles. I've always been interested in African reptiles, more so than any African mammal, personally. But yeah, Namibia is pretty high up on my list because I really want to get that, like, desert herps is what
Of
I really like
course,
to see.
that's good. Namibia is amazing. It's like Shangri-La for geckos. It's like the best place, and the vipers, amazing. So, but honestly speaking, like just saying, you know, if you ever come to South Africa, drop me a message. I'll take you out 100% one time. So let me know.
Well,
I'll
now I
take
need to
you out
save
to
up
go
for a
find some
tight.
stuff.
Now I need to save up for an airline ticket, so.
No, 100%. Once you get here, you sort it. I'll take you out to see some cool things. We can even go to Namibia if you want. It's quite easy to go from South Africa to Namibia, Botswana, to go to all these countries. So otherwise Namibia is should be high on everyone's list. They've got the awesome ground chameleons, their viper diversity is amazing, they've got some big cobras. And for me, the most exciting part of that country is probably your gecko diversity. It's amazing. It's because geckos just thrive in arid environments. And then your lizards. Lizards are awesome there.
Speaking of geckos and their diversity, have you done any work with those guys?
I have not worked. Actually, no, I have. I have. I have done one. I worked on a new genus we described. It's called Boreas. We named it actually in honor of Professor Aaron Bauer. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he's like the gecko man for the whole planet. Like he's like the he works at the University of Villanova, I think. Yeah, and he's a very, very, very proficient herpetologist, one of the best in the world, and he's like the gecko guy. So. We when we found this genus, we what was one of Bill Branch's last wishes was to name this genus after Aaron Bauer, as he was a close friend of his. So yeah, so that's how that came to be. I've worked on that gecko from Angola, but other than that, I haven't worked on any other geckos since. There's a lot of research on geckos at the moment, so there's no need for me to work there right now.
Well, it's gonna some of my nose aren't sorry.
Don't worry, it's
Trying to
fine.
stop, trying to hold off a sneeze, but
Oh, don't ever battle a sneeze, you'll lose.
You mentioned you did work with vipers and boom slangs. Have you done any work with elapids?
Elapids. To be honest with you, no. I haven't really done stuff on elapids yet. The cobra research has been pretty, for taxonomy specific. So systematics, genetics, phylogeography, that's all been pretty well done by Wolfgang Wuster for Niger. I know someone that's worked on Hemichartis or the Ringhals recently. Sea snakes, they're pretty much well done. We only get the one in Africa. We get the yellow-bellied sea snake. And then the other ones that we have, I'm not particularly working on them, but I know a lot of people that are. So you've got aspid laps, and you've got a handful of other interesting ones as well. But yeah, currently, it's not a focus of mine.
Okay. Let's see here. Do you keep any animals personally as like pets or something like that?
I used to have big brown house snakes, so one of our local ones. And then at one point I had a ball python, and the reason I kept them was because I used to when I was in Grahamstown, which was in southern South Africa, so like on the coast there. When I was at university, I used to do a lot of snake education. So I'd go to local schools, both in the local communities and in the private schools. So basically a very broad thing. And I would do snake education for the kids. Often I'd use local indigenous animals as well. But obviously I wouldn't let a kid hold a cobra. So it is a bit dangerous. So I'd let them hold the ball python or the brown house snake because they were chilled. And the goal was kind of just to get knowledge out there. Unfortunately, like the whole world, everyone's scared of snakes. Snakes are very mythical creatures, and it holds true, especially in Africa, because people are living in close proximity to these very dangerous animals. They develop, quite an intense fear of these animals. So a large part of what I was doing in my spare time when I was studying was to do snake education for kids, especially African kids, and give them an opportunity to see these animals in a different light. Because if you can just change the perception of one kid towards a venomous or potentially venomous or any kind of animal, then you can make a big difference. So that was a big part of what I did when I was still developing as a young scientist. Unfortunately, I'm moving around so much, I can't really do that anymore. But I was a big part of my kind of growing up stage as a scientist was to do a lot of snake education, snake awareness, reptile awareness, and try and break some of those stereotypes and also just make kids smile, because I was taught to love snakes by a guy that was doing the same thing. So it's almost like paying it forward, do it for someone else. You make the lives of some of these kids, because there's such an awesome opportunity, especially if you grow up with nothing and someone shows you this beautiful thing that lives outside you. Hopefully one day we can get more African herpetologists, because that's one thing we really need in Africa. We need more local scientists making a big difference. There are some really good ones, but there's always space for more.
Yeah. Gotcha. You mentioned that whole not letting kids hold cobras. That just reminded me of one place I worked at. As a tourist place. It was an alligator park, but we had a coach whip there, but we didn't have a sign on his enclosure saying what he was. So people kept asking what he was. So he's like, "Oh, I'll tell you." Open the cage, get him out, and say, "Oh, yes, a juvenile black mamba. Don't worry, they don't become venomous until they're adults."
Actually, that didn't go down well there.
After a bit,
they must have skin skipped. Yeah, you told them eventually.
After a bit, it's like, no, it's just a harmless coach whip. So
they must have thought you were crazy. They must have, this guy's got a death wish. Sure.
Yeah, the best part was that some would actually believe the part where we said, "Oh, they don't actually become venomous until they're fully grown adults." So
yeah, I know, it's crazy. Yeah, some of the myths that surround animals is ridiculous. Like the things I've heard over the years is amazing. Like. And you have to try and break those stereotypes without laughing at them too much, because otherwise you just alienate people. But yeah, they are some.
Yeah.
And like some of the things I've been told are crazy.
Yeah. For me personally, where I live, Ohio, everyone and their mother swears we have venomous cottonmouths in our waterways and stuff like that. Cottonmouths don't even live inside the state. They're like 100, 200 miles away from even the state border. It's too far north for them, but we have northern brown water snake. Yeah. We have banded water snakes, which look a lot like them. So
they do look a lot like them. They've even got me. Last time I was there, I saw a banded water snake. I'm like, oh, look, it's like, and obviously you look closely and you can see the body shape is wrong. But yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah,
yeah. So it's always kind of frustrating to tell people, it's like, no, that's not a cottonmouth. It's just a water snake. So.
Yes, of course, and that's part of the job. You have to, every time you do it, you say it in the nicest way you can and with all the enthusiasm in the world, because you don't want to be that one person that you snapped with. You're like, I've told you like 1,000 times, there's none of these things here. But it's the same as Africa. Like, I was working in Eastern Cape, and every single person would tell me that they had green mambas on their farm. And green mambas exist on the KwaZulu-Natal coast. And that was over 700 kilometers away. And I was like, they're not here. And they're like, no. My neighbor is a snake handler and he's seen one. Like one guy, one time, read a one snake book, knows more than anyone else. And he's like, that's a green mamba. And I'm like, how big was it? They're like, no. It was huge. And most time people are over embellished. They're always over embellished. Yeah. Like you find a snake that big and it's a 5 meter mamba. You're like, how did you guys get to that? And every mamba story I've ever heard is the mamba is like 5 meters long and it was twice my height and then it like stole my firstborn child. I'm like, yes, these stories are like mythical of these mambas. But like most of the time you come across a mamba, they are so scared of you. They just go the other way. their reputation is atrocious. Unfortunately, it doesn't help that most TV shows play on that stereotype. They like antagonize the snakes before they film them, and then the snake's pissed off. Well, because you've been antagonizing it for 25 minutes. Generally speaking, you find a wild mamba, they're going to be gone within seconds. They don't want to mess with you. They're only if you corner them are they dangerous. But same for the green mambas. For years, I had this the same old lady come into all my snake talks asking me if I'd seen the green mamba yet. I'm like, oh, I still haven't seen it yet. But you never know. You never know. It could be here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you work with the South African Institute of Aquatic Biodiversity. Want to talk about your work with them?
Yeah, so obviously I'm employed by Hankuzi Explorations, but as a scientist, I'm affiliated to that institution. The reason for that is that because they're based in Grahamstown, so they are affiliated with Rhodes University, the university I studied at, and they obviously are very fish-centric. They love fish research, but it's aquatics, so they also have a massive component of their research has to be focused on amphibians. So I represent the amphibian component. So whenever I publish research, they are an affiliate on my papers, and it's like a partnership. I don't get paid by them, but the work I do benefits the institute. And then obviously what they do in exchange is that they can help me sometimes with paying for conference fees or help me out with research costs. So I'm affiliated to them. I don't work there. I'm affiliated with the research at the institute. So every time you see one of my papers come out, you'll see that university in the byline there somewhere, representing their frog component of their institute.
Okay, gotcha. I was just asking because I was kind of curious if South Africa has something analogous to like Nerodia or water snakes here in North America.
We do. We have several water snake groups. So you've got the Lycodonomorphus, which is literally called water snakes. You get the brown water snake, you get the dusky billy water snake. Some of them are very much intrinsically linked with water, like to the point that if they leave the water for long, they'll literally desiccate and they'll dry out. They only eat fish and frogs, to some that are called water snakes, but they live in marshes and they can kind of go far away, to one that kind of isn't even a water snake. So the group is called water snakes, but they're linked to water is kind of gray area. And then you've got things like marsh snakes in Africa. You get swamp snakes. So we've got a lot of groups of snakes that are linked with fresh water. So you've got things, especially around wetlands. We have a lot of snakes that like wetlands because wetlands is where most of our biodiversity in these tropical regions is, because especially for frogs. So obviously everyone thinks when you see a river or a lake or a dam, you're going to find lots of frogs. But unfortunately, because it's a lake or a river, it's a larger body of water. So it has fish, and fish predate on tadpoles. So if you've got a temporary water body in a wetland, and the water dries up every now and then the fish can't exist there. So the tadpoles are basically don't have a predator. So whenever we find wetlands in Africa, that's where you're going to find a lot of frogs. And because of that, the snakes follow suit. You always find tons of snakes around wetlands.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that question I just asked kind of highlights, it might just be me, but something I've noticed is here in the U.S. when we talk about African reptiles and African amphibians, it almost exclusively revolves around the cobras, mambas and boomslangs, the vipers and the pythons and all these other non-venomous groups. Like you guys have garter snakes, you have the whip snakes, all this stuff. It's almost like forgotten about compared to the more charismatic venomous and pythons, it seems like. At least immediately.
Yes, 100%. No, it's also the herpes. Like I've taken two or three American herpes out and everyone's like, I want to see bitters. I want to see vipers. I want to see cobras. And then obviously the chameleons are up there on the list. And then everyone wants to see Ouroboros. So the armadillo girdle lizard, the one that bites his tail, like that one is up there. Monitor lizards are up there. Some of the geckos, but definitely the snakes, the venomous snakes take center stage. Everyone wants to see a boomslang, a wrinkles, a cape cobra, and like all these dwarf adders. They are high on the list. So it makes sense. Even for us, it's an exciting group. Like when I came to America, I wanted to see an eastern diamondback rattlesnake. I'm like, I should want to see all the other stuff, but I want to see an eastern diamondback. And what I'm particularly obsessed with about America, what I absolutely love is your salamanders. They are out of this world. I love salamanders so much. I even said to someone, if someone offered me a postdoc in salamanders, I'd take it immediately and work. I'll move to America because we don't get salamanders in Africa really, and only in like the northern limit, like Morocco, we get the one. But you guys have like the Smoky Mountains, like in North
Yeah.
Carolina. Like you have, the densities of salamanders is out this world. They're like wet sausage dogs. They're like the greatest thing that's ever been made. Like I just think salamanders are the coolest things ever. And they're so easy to photograph because they're so slow. It's so much more
Yeah.
fun to photograph them than snakes. So I definitely think you guys are winning so hard with your salamanders. I love them to bits.
Yeah. Growing up, just watching media as a kid, stuff like that, I always felt kind of jaded about where I lived in terms of my native herp diversity because where I live, don't really have any venomous snakes in my immediate region. Don't have any crocodilians where I live. Obviously, it gets a little too cold for them. And don't have it. I actually have, in my part of the state, there's no wild lizards. You have to go to other parts of the state to actually have wild lizards.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Ohio has only, I'll say, five species of native lizard, and one of those is invasive.
Wow, it's actually low. It's low diversity, eh?
Yeah.
Cool. Okay.
But let's see here. I lost my train of thought. But oh, yeah. But now I'm getting older and realize, oh, there's actually plenty of diversity in other stuff. Like, Eastern United States has the highest diversity of freshwater turtles compared to anywhere else on the planet.
Yeah, it's so cool. Your turtles in America are amazing. There's just
Yeah.
so many of them, and like your snapping turtles are like dinosaurs. Are like when I saw my
Yeah.
first one, it was like it's huge. It's a
Yeah.
huge animal.
Yeah. And like you mentioned, our salamanders, I've heard some say that maybe South America has higher diversity, but others say that it's the Eastern United States that has the highest diversity of salamanders of anywhere on the planet. So that's
It
always,
does, yeah.
that's also,
It does have. It has the highest. Yeah, it has the highest. No, they're
yeah.
beautiful animals. Your salamanders are amazing. And that's the one nice thing about America. Like, no matter where you go, you've got different groups that are better in certain places. Like, obviously, you go into like North Carolina, you go into New Mexico, Arizona, you're going to have a lot of crotalus. You're going to have a lot of them there. You're going to have a lot of arid adapted lizards. But then you go to North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, then it becomes salamander country. Then you go down to Florida, and then it's like invasive reptile country. Like you're not going to find an indigenous thing, but everything's
Well,
exciting. It's like there's an iguana there. There are obviously lots of things, but like when I went to the Everglades, I saw more invasive stuff than I saw indigenous stuff, which was quite crazy.
yeah.
Until you look really closely, then you can start like the annals. You guys have so many annals down there.
Well, those are also a lot of them are invasive as well, so.
Yeah, on every bush I was looking, and they actually, I think annuals are very similar in term in to finding them to chameleons because they're like they'll hang on bushes and they'll kind of be
Yeah.
like white under white light. So if you go to spotting annuals, you're going to do really well in finding chameleons in Africa. Very similar way of looking for them.
Okay. Well, I was going to say Florida also has chameleons as well, so
You do, yeah. You have the veil there. There's the veil that's been released there.
yeah, I think there might also be panthers as well, but I have to double check.
The panthers, sorry, I think it's the panthers. So I get confused with one it is. I just know there's
I
definitely
think they're both
chameleons there.
there. I know for certain
Are
veils
they?
are.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, it's amazing. I've been told. Next time there's the guy. I went to Florida like earlier this year. They're like, you must go look for the chameleons. I'm like, no, I'd rather go look for them in Africa.
Yeah. I want to actually photograph them in the trees they're supposed to be in, so.
Yeah, it would be nice to, yeah, but like if you can see them, if you live in America, you can see chameleons in the wild. That's still pretty cool. I'm not going to say no to that. Like,
Yeah.
it's interesting to go see them. Yeah.
Yeah. So is there anywhere in the world that you haven't had a chance to go herping in yet that you want to? That's like top of
Oh,
your list.
there's a lot.
Okay, well, like
Huge. There's a
top of
huge
your list
amount. Like,
then. Yeah.
I think Borneo. Borneo is going to be up there. Borneo is like the one. They're having the World Congress of Herpetology there coming up now. I didn't have time to go. I would have loved to. So Malaysia is high up there. I did Costa Rica last year for the first time, which is amazing. So that was top three. So Costa
Yeah,
Rica is amazing. Yeah,
I'm going
you
there
love
later
Costa
this
Rica.
year, so.
Oh, it's beautiful, man. Yes, that place. If you like reptiles and amphibians, it's like the most amazing place. Like it's in some ways, I like it more than Africa. It's like different. It's just so different. So Costa Rica is up there for me, Borneo, and I would like to do Amazon. Like Amazon would be nice, and then Northern Australia. Go to like places
Yeah.
like, you go to Darwin and you can find some of the highest diversity of varanus in the world. Australia is also amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, someone who also really likes keeping Morelia, Australia is very high on my list as well. So,
of course. Yeah. So, no, Australia is going to be, it has to be in the top. Like, I think a good top five would probably be Costa Rica, Borneo, Australia, somewhere in Africa. If you can get into like tropical Africa, like at least one. So like Gabon would be amazing. If you can get to Gabon. Congo is cool, but this is epic. But you can go to, if you go to Ethiopia, very good. Kenya, also very good. So there's a, I think there's a herpetology. You're never going to run out of place to go. And even some of like these smaller countries also have amazing biodiversity. Like you go to Honduras or you go to Thailand or you go into Spain. Even Spain's got some crazy stuff. Like, everywhere in the world is going to have awesome reptiles and amphibians if you know where to look.
Yeah. Well, I don't have any questions off the top of my head at the moment. Is there anything else you want to talk about before I wrap up?
No. It was great to meet you. Thank you for having me on your podcast. And like I said, honestly, if you come through South Africa, you know who to contact. I can also put you in contact with other guys. And anyone else on you listening to your podcast, they want to have some pro tips on where to go and where not to go. I'm happy to answer messages or emails. Happy to answer. And if you've got a country you want to go to in Africa, I've got a pretty good network. I can put you in contact with some of the more reliable guys in all the different places. I'm always happy to help and see other herpers. I find the American herp community is amazing. Last time I was there, I just asked guys for help, and they just gave me help so freely. So I do not mind paying back. So, yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of which, how people get in contact with you, how can they get in contact with you?
You can follow my Instagram page. You can contact me via Instagram, Facebook. I've got a website, chadkeys.co.za. You can get my email right there, and I'm happy for you to put my email on the podcast. And I reply to email faster than anything else. So, yeah, email is good. And even if they contact me, you can get my cell number as well. I don't mind. So, yeah.
All right. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, it's a pleasure, and thanks. And good luck. Good luck in Costa Rica. That's going to be amazing.
Can't wait.
You're going to have so much fun. Where are you going, by the way?
The San Jose greater region. So.
Okay. Are you going to go? Are you going to try get to Limón province?
I had to double check that itinerary. I got it through like a guided tour. So.
If you're going to guided tour, they're going to sort you out. They know that place like the back of their hand. Yeah, you're going to have a great time. Yeah. But yeah, we'll stay in contact. And